Wow, you all know how to do this up. This is fantastic. Just, no wonder you come for 50 years. This is too much fun. I would have to come to the next 49 for the rest of my life plus 25 years in order to get the numbers that some of y'all have in terms of being here. So that's really exciting. Let me say a word of prayer, and let's take a look at the Book of Lamentations again today. God, we're thankful for just the wonderful family that this church is and the ways you've blessed this community, with your presence, your community, your fellowship, your real deep presence of love and grace and mercy in this place. So I thank you for the history of a community that has loved one another for decades and how that love continues to this day and even goes to the generation after and the generation after that. So we are thankful that these kinds of gifts are rare in many of our lives, and I thank you for the work you're doing here. In your name we pray. Amen. All right, so we're going to take a look at the Book of Lamentations again today. I'm looking at our three sessions together, kind of as a continuum. So I didn't get to a couple of things last night. We'll pick up on it today. And then if I don't get to some of the stuff, we'll pick up on it tonight. And if I don't get to all of it, you pick up my book. So that's available at the bookstore. I've written six books, but two of the books on Kindle, Amazon right now, they're having a special sale until the end of May. Next Evangelicalism, which was my first book, and Prophetic Lament, which was written about came out about 2 years ago. If you prefer Kindle versus a hard copy, $4.97. They for the month of May they're doing a special on two of my books. So if you want to check those out and you like the Kindle edition of a book, it's hard for me to sign a copy of a Kindle edition, though. I just want to let you know, up front, it's hard to do that. But those, if you are preferring the Kindle edition, that's going to be available. I'm going to try to stop about 5 to 10 minutes before the scheduled stop for me for talking this morning. So if you have any questions from last night, things that you've been kind of mulling over and worth discussing as a group, or anything that comes up in the next 30 minutes or so, if you want to actually have a little bit of time to discuss some of these comments and these things that I've written and talking about, jot those questions down, and I really want to make sure that we have some time of interaction and a chance to engage this topic with some Q&A. So I'll try to stop at about 11:10, 11:05 or so, and we'll leave about 5 to 10 minutes for Q&A. I think there's about a 45-minute break before lunch. I would love to stick around and just do some Q&A on top of that. I really miss, because as I mentioned last night, I was a preacher for 17 years as a pastor. I love preaching, but I've been also a teacher for the past 11 years, so I love teaching. So the opportunity to do more of the preaching, but also some of the teaching. So for today, we're going to do a little bit of both. But in order to kind of get some of the feedback that I appreciate as a teacher, I want to make sure that we have some time for interaction at the end. All right? So jot down your questions and jot down some things as we go along this morning. Well, we're going to take a look at Lamentations chapter 1 through 3. We're going to cover three chapters this morning. I do want to pick up, though, some of the threads from last night, especially when we're talking about the need to hear all of the voices when we're dealing with lament. That one of the powerful aspects of lament is that the voices of everyone, and I mentioned that within the nation of Israel at this time, there were specific groups that were particularly marginalized. And that would have been the women and the children, the sick, the lame, the blind, those who would have been the marginalized of that society. Lament and Lamentations is very intentional about making sure that those voices are elevated. The most privileged voice in the city of Jerusalem at that time and in the Book of Lamentations would be the voice of Jeremiah, but he more or less disappears from the book. Even though he's probably the editor or the curator of the book, his voice disappears, and he wants the voice of especially the women, the children, the lame, the sick, the crippled, the blind. Those are the voices he wants to elevate, and that's what I talked about last night, that it's very important that we understand how significant it is that Jeremiah, the privileged person, moves out of the way so that the voice of the marginalized can be heard. So when we read through Lamentations, we have to read and understand with that lens in mind that Jeremiah and God is trying to elevate the voices of the marginalized in this. And we see this in the context of where the Book of Lamentations was written. I'm going to do a little bit of understanding of the context. The first three verses reads like this: how deserted lies the city, once so full of people. How like a widow is she who was once great among the nations, she who was a queen among the provinces has now become a slave. So we're getting a little bit of insight into what precipitates the writing of the Book of Lamentations. We see that this once great city, the city of Jerusalem, has fallen on hard times. the Assyrian powers first come from the north and wipe out the northern kingdom of Israel. And then the Babylonians come and wipe out the southern kingdom of Israel, Judah. And then all that's left is the city of Jerusalem. And you know that Jerusalem had once been this great city filled with people, filled with riches and wealth and power and splendor and majesty. Jerusalem was very much a significant and important city, the capital of the Promised Land. But that once great city, as seen in verse 1, is now like a widow. She was once great among the nations, this city, queen among the provinces, but has now become a slave. And this once great city now weeps bitterly at night. Tears are on her cheeks among all her lovers. There is no one to comfort her. All her friends have betrayed her. They have become her enemies. So this image of this stark contrast between a city and a nation, Jerusalem and Israel, that had once been great in the eyes of the world and in the eyes of God, now because of the conquest of the Babylonians over Jerusalem, they are now alone. They are now isolated. They have lost everything. Verse 3, after affliction and harsh labor, Judah has gone into exile and she dwells among the nations. She finds no resting place. All who pursue her have overtaken her in the midst of her distress. And I mentioned this last night, that one of the outcomes and the negative aspects of this conquest of Jerusalem is that the most privileged, the learned, the intelligentsia, the intellectuals, the leaders, the prophets, the priests and kings were yanked out of Jerusalem and taken away into exile into Babylon. Again, that's where we encounter the story of Daniel and his friends, because these folks who Babylon said, we don't want them rebuilding Jerusalem. We don't want them rebuilding Israel's society. So let's take those people who might be able to do that, send them away into exile, and that's where they end up in Babylon, but not in Jerusalem. So Jeremiah writes a letter in Jeremiah chapter 29 to the exiles, and he talks about two potential responses to this tragedy. Clearly, this is a tragic situation. Clearly, the nation of Israel is defeated, broken, lost, and Jeremiah writes this letter in response, and he gives them two things they should not do. And the first we're going to look at is, you should not give up even though you are a broken and fallen people. Do not give up, even though the world around you has crumbled. Even though you are in exile, you do not have the option of giving up. Jeremiah 29, verses 4 through 7, probably a passage that's familiar to many of you. This is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says to those I sent into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. Build houses, settle down, plant gardens, eat what they produce, marry and have sons and daughters, find wives for your sons and give your daughters in marriage, so that they too may have sons and daughters. Increase in number there, do not decrease. Also, verse 7, seek the peace and prosperity of the city to which I have carried you into exile. Pray to the Lord for it, because if it prospers, you too will prosper. So think about the context. You're sent away into exile. You've lost the promised land. You've lost all hope that Jerusalem will ever be restored. And the prophet who predicted all these things now writes a letter to you saying, you are not only going to be in Babylon for just a little bit, you're going to be in Babylon for quite some time. In fact, you should get used to that idea, and you can get used to that idea by living your life. Continuing to live your life as God's people, have children, settle down. And then the kicker here in verse 7, seek the peace, not of Jerusalem, which is what 99.9% of the Bible says, seek the peace of Jerusalem. This is one of the very rare exceptions where God says, not seek the peace of Jerusalem, but seek the peace of Babylon. And this makes no sense to the nation of Israel. They are always have been told, seek the peace of Jerusalem. But now they're being told, seek the peace of Babylon. It's like being told as an outsider, seek the peace of San Francisco. How can good ever come from that wicked city? Seek the peace of Las Vegas. How can good ever come out of that wicked city? Seek the peace of this broken city. Seek the peace of this broken nation. Seek the peace of this broken world. So God says to his people, even if you live in the worst place imaginable, Babylon. Babylon is Vegas, San Francisco, New York, Washington, D.C., all rolled up into one. And God says you are to seek the peace of Babylon. Babylon, if you look throughout the Bible over and over again, is the epitome of evil and everything that is broken and wrong with the world. That's what Babylon stands for. And yet this passage says, not seek the peace of Jerusalem, God's heavenly city, the city of David, the capital of the promised land, but seek the peace of Babylon. In other words, even if you are in the worst place imaginable, the most broken, sinful reality you can imagine, Babylon, you still, as God's people, are not allowed to give up. Christians, we never have the option of giving up. And we can complain about the world is falling apart, society's falling apart, everything around us is changing. Things aren't the way they were 30 years ago. Things aren't the way they were 5 years ago. And we can make all sorts of excuses to say, why should we keep going when the world around us is falling apart? Well, God says to the people of his people in Jeremiah, I don't care how broken and messed up the world is. I don't care if you think you've lost everything. God's people never, ever have the option of running away and giving up. We continue to seek the peace, even if it's in the midst of Babylon and not in the midst of Jerusalem. Now, I raise this as a historian because when you look at American church history, the church has actually often given up and run away and hid. One of those examples is that in the 19th and 20th century, when the cities began to change from these wonderful places where white Anglo-Saxon Protestants would gather for worship, and then all of a sudden, Southern Europeans and Eastern Europeans and African Americans and Latinos started moving into these cities. And many of these white Anglo-Saxon Protestant churches said, you know, the city's not so safe for us anymore. The city's not good for our kids to go to school. The city is now, the real estate prices are suffering in the city. The city is not a good place for us to raise kids. It's no longer safe, so let's run away from the city and hide out in the suburbs. And so a lot of what we see in the 19th and especially 20th century is the flight of Christians from the city rather than staying and saying, how can we seek God's peace in the midst of this? We can do this geographically, leaving the city for the suburbs. We can do this socio-psychologically and saying the world is broken anyway, so let's run away and hide. Let's take our kids and let's take our family and make sure that they're not connecting with the world around us because the world around us is so fallen. Let's run away and hide. And if you look at the history of the church in the United States, you see that pattern over and over and over again where the church, instead of saying we're going to seek the peace of God's work even in the most broken places, we say let's run away and hide. Instead of thinking about how we can maybe redeem the secular schools, let's make sure we're at Christian schools. Instead of trying to redeem the work in secular literature, we say, let's make our own literature. Instead of maybe seeking ways that we can bring the light of Christ into secular music, let's make our own mediocre, not so good Christian music. And so we end up running away and hiding when we should be seeking the peace, even in the most broken places. Now, I raise this because the changes that occur in our society are constant. Different changes occur at different times. I actually showed the slide the last time that I was here. But the changes that are occurring are happening at a very rapid rate. And so, again, we have the option as a church to run away and hide or to seek the peace of the world around us, to seek the peace of a changing society. In 1965, the immigration laws in our nation changed. Prior to 1965, there were explicit laws that said we don't want certain types of people in our country. The first of these laws was called the Chinese Exclusion Act. Can anybody guess what that did? Yeah, it was pretty clear. They weren't hiding anything here. We don't want Chinese people. We're going to write the Chinese Exclusion Act to exclude Chinese people. Pretty clear what they were trying to do. They were saying, and this was the first of these acts in the United States, to say, we don't trust the immigrants from this part of the world, so we're going to make an explicit law that says nobody can come from this part of the world. I'm so glad that hundreds of years later, we don't do that anymore in our country. But what we had here in 1965 was an attempt to say, you know what, those laws were pretty racist. So let's not have those kinds of laws that say we can't have immigrants from here, we can't have immigrants from here. So there was an attempt to say, well, let's receive immigrants from all over the world. Now, one of the things that did not happen in 1965 was we only took 200,000 immigrants in 1965, let's take 6 million the next year. That did not happen. That has never happened in American history. There's never been a moment where we said, let's just throw open the doors and 10 million immigrants will come in. That has never happened. It went from 200,000 to 210,000, and then 220,000, and eventually to about 500,000, but over a 50-year period of time. There has always been a limitation and quota system on immigration in the United States. There's never been unfettered, this hordes of people coming through. That just hasn't happened. That's just not the reality. What we've had is smaller incremental change in immigration, but the main change in 1965 was not the size of the pie of immigration, but the distribution of the pie within immigration. So that immigration that occurred in 1965 that was mostly Europe and Canada now became African, Asian, and Latin American immigration. And since 1965, this slow, gradual, but steady influx of non-European immigrants has meant that our nation has changed very dramatically over the last 50 years. You see the numbers. By 2008, a third of our U.S. population were ethnic minorities. By 2011, we had passed a birth rate issue. By 2023, half of all children in the United States will be of non-European descent. Now, by the way, Northern California hit that like 10 years earlier. Those numbers are already in play here in Northern California. By 2042, half of the entire U.S. population will be of non-European descent. What I want to point out is how 2011, 2023, and 2042 are directly linked to one another. The fact is, according to the Pew Research Foundation, a conservative Christian organization that does research on this, from 2009 to 2014, over a five-year period, the net immigration from Mexico was negative 140,000 people. So there again is not the hordes of people trying to come into the United States. The net immigration over a five-year period, one of the more recent statistics, is that we lost immigrants to Mexico, not gained immigrants from Mexico. The diversity in America is not due to immigration. It is due to birth rates. So no matter how big of a wall Mexico builds for us, forget the wall. I am advocating for a new thing. Let's build a dome. We're going to build a dome. We're going to hermetically seal off the United States. Canada will pay for it. We will seal off the United States with a dome. And these numbers will not change one bit. Diversity in America is here, not because of immigration. Those numbers are minuscule compared to the birth rate numbers. In other words, diversity is here to stay. Deal with it. Deal with that reality. So what we have to understand now is, there's never a time in American church history where change will not be what's going on around us. It's not what that change is not the reality that we have to worry about. It's how will the church respond to that change that we have to worry about. Change will always happen in some form or another in our society, in our nation, in our cities, in our worlds, our families. There will always be something that challenges us, some kind of change, some kind of factor that makes us anxious, nervous, maybe even fearful. The question is never, will these changes occur or how do we stop these changes? The question is, how will we as God's people respond to these changes? And like I said, historically, the church has run away and hid. When chapter 29 says, don't run away and hide. Seek the peace of even the most broken places in the world. That's the challenge for us as a church. Now, I'll say this as kind of a side note, but I'm kind of at a stage in my life where I've kind of been through a lot of mission conferences. I love mission conferences. One of the most important mission conferences for me was, this is telling you how old I am, back in 1987 when I went to the Urbana Mission Conference, 1987, dramatically challenged by Tony Campolo and Billy Graham, Roberta Hestenez. It was one of the best Urbana Missions conferences. Now, what I remember is I went there as a student in 87 and then as a staff worker in 90 and 94, and then as a pastor and then as a speaker in 2000. So I went to Urbana for about 15 straight years in different capacities. But when I went to Urbana, I noticed a couple of trends in not just Urbana, but all these different mission conferences. When I first started going to these mission conferences, one of the most significant conversations we were having was the most unreached people group at that time in the 80s and 90s, and that was the Communist Bloc nations. You all remember that? There were books written about it. Major speakers would come in to talk about how are we going to reach China in particular with the gospel of Jesus Christ? How are we going to reach the Soviet Union? And how are we going to get behind the Iron Curtain? And we prayed and fasted and held conference after conference. Missiologists wrote books and books about how we're going to reach the gospel of Jesus Christ into places like China, the Soviet Union, and Eastern Europe. And guess what? God answered that prayer in a powerful, dramatic way. In my last year in seminary, my mission professor was an Eastern European. By that time, the communist block wall, the Berlin Wall had fallen, the Iron Curtain had lifted, and the gospel was now able to go in to the very places we had been praying for. God performed the miracle and allowed the gospel to go forth. By the way, some of you might already know this, but what is, in terms of actual numbers of Christians, what is the most Christian nation in the world right now? China. Good. You all know this stuff. Absolutely. Now, the official state numbers from the Chinese government is that there are only 30 million Christians in China. That's the official state church. But the second you start adding this underground church movement in, you're getting to about 200, 250, even maybe as high as 300 million. 250 million is the numbers that get floated out there. So you count the underground church in China, there are anywhere from 200 to 300 million Christians in China right now. What's the population of the United States? 300 million. So we're talking about more Christians in China than there might be even people in the United States. And we're talking about that's the number of Christians in China. China right now, in terms of actual numbers, is the most Christian nation in the world. So what happened? God answered our prayers. We prayed for the miracle that this closed nations that we said the gospel can never go, all of a sudden, God has answered the prayers and the gospel is doing fantastic in these nations. So we knew that. We learned that. Missiologists figured that out and said, all right, what's our next target of prayer? Who do we want to pray for next? So now we shifted away from the former communist nations. Who do we pray for now in almost every mission conference for the last 25 years? What people group? Muslims. Muslims. Books, volumes of books have been written about how do we reach Muslims? Conference after conference, how do we reach the Muslims? Speaker after speaker comes in and talk about what are the ways we're going to creatively reach the Muslim community. And guess what? God answered prayer again. And he said, American Christians, you've been praying for the Muslim community for decades now. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to send you 20,000 refugees from the Middle East who want to become your friends, who want to learn about Christianity, and who now have the freedom to do so. And I'll send them every year. 20,000 refugees. That's all I'm asking from the American church. If every church in America adopted 1/5 of a refugee, we could cover every single refugee and then some. But who are the ones in the public media anyway that stood at the gate and said, we don't want these terrorists to come into our shores? Christians, evangelical Christians, who stood at the gate and said, no, we don't want you here, when for 25 years we've been praying, Lord, teach us how to reach the Muslim community. God says, sure, here are 25,000 neighbors of yours, and we say, no, we don't want you here. Seek the peace of the city to which I have brought you. Seek the peace of the society that I'm bringing to you. Don't pine for what it was 50 years ago, because that's not coming back. Seek the peace of even Babylon, the most broken place on earth. Christians, we never, ever have the option of running away and hiding when the world around us changes. In fact, that's when we rise up. That's when we say we have been called by God to be the peacemakers, to be the ones who bring hope into broken communities. So that first option that Jeremiah mentions in chapter 29 is we never ever have the option of giving up. But here's the other part of the equation. The second option that Jeremiah dismisses is you can't give up and you certainly can't give in. You can't give in to what's going on in the world around us. One of the major attributes of Babylonian society is that they were idolaters, but they were also very much the culture was magic culture. or divination culture. And that's why Jeremiah points out, you are not to listen to the prophets, here it means false prophets, and the diviners among you. You can't let them deceive you. Divination was specifically a Babylonian practice. In other words, I know you're in Babylon, but you are not to become like the Babylonians. I know you think that God is lost, but you're not to go out there and find another person or another religious practice to take its place. So the practice of divination was very much a temptation, as you see here in verse 8, very much a temptation for the people of God. Here's how divination works. It is simply a magic formula. That's why divination and idolatry was so attractive to God's people. Because idolatry works on one level. You need to know that. Idolatry actually works. Because idolatry operates like a vending machine. You go to a vending machine, you have your $5 to buy that Diet Coke. So you put in those $5 and you punch in the letter and number that corresponds to Diet Coke, J5. And a Diet Coke comes out because the picture says J5 equals a Diet Coke. Now, if Mountain Dew comes out, you're very upset. That's not what's supposed to happen. There is an 800 number you can call to voice your discontent. By the way, I've called those. It goes to, like, nowhere. Nobody answers at the other end of those calls. But the concept is, and it breaks down, if you don't get what you want, you ask for it, you did the right thing by putting in the right amount of money and typing in the right numbers, your expectation is you're going to get exactly what you asked for, which is the way divination works. Follow the formula. You want good crops, do the following things. You want a male-born offspring, do the following things. And so idolatry and divination was always a very strong temptation for the people of God because the worship of Yahweh does not work like that. The worship of Yahweh is never a magic formula. It's never A plus B will always equal C. The worship of Yahweh is not what he can do for you, but who he is. And the people of God were always tempted in the Bible over and over again to follow the idols and the magic practices which said there's a simpler way. There are shortcuts. There are easier ways to get what you want. Just follow the magic formula of the divination practices of the nation of Israel, of the nation of Babylon, of the people of Babylon. And because of that, we end up following these patterns of behavior that are more secular than Christian. We follow the patterns of behavior that are more driven by societal norms than by the norms of Christianity, the norms of our scripture. One of these things I think I mentioned the last time I was here, this whole idea that churches are better if we just hang out with people that are like us. I mean, that was very much a principle that was used by churches for 40 years. From the 1970s forward up until maybe the last 10 years, most churches said, we're better, stronger, more efficient, and more effective if we just hang out with people that are like us. We don't have to worry about costs and cultures. We don't have to worry about socioeconomic educational differences. We don't have to change the way we worship. We don't have to change the way we talk. We don't have to change anything about ourselves because when we hang out with people like ourselves, we're comfortable. And we like what that means for our church. It comes from actually a sociological concept called homophily, from the Greek proverb that says birds of a feather like to flock together. And so we want churches that buy into not a biblical concept. The biblical concept is not, let's just get a group of fishermen. No, we're going to have to throw a tax collector into the mix. Let's just get a group of folks like this who look like us and talk like us and think like us and act like us. That's the real church. No, the Bible is, in Revelation chapter 7, verse 9, all the nations, tribes, languages, cultures, ethnicities, nationalities will be before the throne of God. It is in contrast to this idea of birds of a feather needs to flock together. So the idea of Scripture stands in contrast to the worldly value of homophily, which says if you really want things to work, you need one cultural norm. You need one cultural value system. Now, the problem here, though, is that one cultural norm and that one cultural value system, as I mentioned a little bit last night, privileges one perspective over and against the other. The point of view that is the dominant point of view in our larger society needs to become the point of view of everybody in the church. So that now what we're seeing is there is a perspective that is the dominant perspective. And that dominant perspective has the right to impose the perspective on everybody else. I'll give you an example of this. This is drawing from the work of Willie Jennings, who was my mentor at Duke University. He was looking at race relations, and he was asking the question, whose point of view, whose gaze, G-A-Z-E, whose gaze and perspective determines how society views the rest of the world? And so he's looking at this relationship between white men, white women, and black women, and he says the white male perspective essentially determines how everybody else is viewed in society. And that perspective means it's the one that everybody else will accept. Example, when the white male looks at the black male, what is the perception of the black male? It's either as a pet or as a threat. And the white male's gaze of the black male as a pet or a threat now becomes determinative for how society now views the black male. Think about the pet illustration of the black male. You see this especially in the entertainment industry, where the black male as comedian, as musician, or as an athlete puts them into the category of pet. In fact, what you don't want from your entertainment person is for them to start becoming a threat. That's why your quarterback, or at least your quarterback on the other side of the bay, when he was a pet, an athlete that didn't say much, he was fine. You loved him. You gave him contracts, and you made him the poster child for your team. But the second he takes a knee during the national anthem, he's no longer a pet. He becomes a threat, and he must be dealt with. And he was. And he's not going to play in the NFL again, because that one-time pet has now become a threat. I'm going to name drop here. Lecrae. I know Lecrae. y'all don't know Lecrae. I know Lecrae. Lecrae's a Christian hip-hop artist. And Lecrae has been phenomenally successful appealing to white youth groups. And his music, which is top-notch hip-hop music, his lyrics are very Christian, very kind of actually Reformed Presbyterian theology. He puts forth a very solid gospel presentation, but through using the venue of hip-hop. Now, one of the things about Lecrae is that in more recent years, he's decided to use that wonderful opportunity that he has as a musician. He starts talking more about race issues. So a few years ago, he tweeted a picture on the 4th of July. This was my family on the 4th of July. It was a picture of a slave family on the plantation. And he moved from being a pet to becoming a threat. And if you go back and look at that Twitter feed, it is outrageous, the racist slurs that are heaped upon Lecrae. Now, up until that time, he was out at every major Christian concert. He was shouted out at major conferences all over the evangelical world. But the second he poses any bit of an intellectual threat, then he was ousted. He was gone. He was out. One of my favorite African-American comedians is Dave Chappelle. Chappelle is awesome. Chappelle walked away, though, from a $40 million contract from Comedy Central. Why? He said, you're trying to make me your pet. You're trying to make me your pet. One of the things he identified is that for black entertainers, especially black comedians, one of the things that happened is that they want to keep us in the pet category. So even the toughest black male comedians, at one point in their career, were appeal in drag. They appear in a show, in a movie, dressed up as a woman. Eddie Murphy, Tyler Perry, Martin Lawrence, Jamie Foxx. These are strong black men intentionally put in drag to emasculate them, to move them from being away from being a threat as a black male to being more of a pet. Now, think with me then about this threat idea of how the gaze of the dominant culture, the white male dominant culture gaze, shapes how the black male is viewed in society. Think with me, the most dangerous human being, according to the 6 o'clock news, on almost every major network or major news channel. The most dangerous human being in American society right now is the unidentified black male. Because the unidentified black male, according to the 6 o'clock news, has committed every single crime in American society. The unidentified black male today shot up a liquor store. Please report this unidentified black male. An unidentified black male was involved in a gang shooting on the south side of Chicago. An unidentified black male on the west side of Chicago was involved in an act of violence. An unidentified black male, and they go on and on about the unidentified black male. This unidentified black male is approximately 15 to 45 years old, weighs anywhere from 150 to 300 pounds, approximately 5'7" and 6'7" tall. If you have seen such a black male, please report this black male to the police immediately because he is a threat to your neighborhood. And that's why the identifying markers now become this unidentified black male was wearing a hoodie. This unidentified black male might be carrying a gun. This identified black male might be a 17-year-old wearing a hoodie with nothing more than Skittles and iced tea in his pocket, but he's a threat, not because he has a weapon, but because he is an unidentified black male. That's a weapon enough. You can be an unidentified black male. You can be a 12-year-old kid prancing around in a public park, and the second the police pull up, that unidentified black male, 12 years old, and if you see the video right before he's gunned down, he is jumping up and down like any 12-year-old would be doing in any park in the United States. But because he's an unidentified black male, the police pull up. Within a second, they've shot a 12-year-old boy because he's an unidentified black male. The question is, how then is the determinative view of the dominant culture shaping our relationship with one another? And how the perspective and point of view, when it is dominated by one perspective, does not allow for the unidentified black male to become a human being, to become a person, a child, a person that could actually be a part of our society and not as a threat. Another aspect of this is, I'm not going to go into this too much, but the unidentified black female, or the black female, as a, this is the work of bell hooks, as either the mammy or the Jezebel, as the one who is the one who provides and love and comfort, or the one who is hypersexualized. In other words, not the way that these present themselves, but the way society presents them, the Oprah and the Beyonce. The large black woman who gives away cars and trips to Australia, and the hypersexualized black woman who seduces white men and seduces others. So we have an image of the black female now that is again determined by the dominant culture perspective. Now, what happens though when the black male looks at the white female? What happens to the black male? He's dead. He's killed. He's killed. He's lynched. By the way, he doesn't even have to look at the white female. The white female could say, he looked at me, which is exactly what happened with Emmett Till. And Emmett Till was impaled and lynched. He was physically crushed by those who lynched. Not because he actually looked at a white female, but because a white female accused the black male of looking at her. So that's the ultimate threat when the black male is now gazing upon the white female. That's why when we have within our culture and our society right now the idea that a male of color is a sexual threat, that cannot be taken lightly, because that opens the door to seeing all men of color as sexual threats. That's why it is not neutral when a presidential candidate says Mexicans are rapists. That was not an accident. That was a deliberate attempt to inflame this paradigm right here, to say men of color are specifically a threat to white women. And therefore, that dominant view now becomes all men of color are threats to our way of life, are threats, whether they are Middle Eastern terrorists or Asian men that try to take white men's jobs or Latino men who are rapists or black men who are going to shoot you. They are a threat to our existence. And it creates this narrative. And again, the question is not, will these things be out there in the world? The question is, how will the church respond? Will we buy into this narrative, or we say we know a different way? This is part of lament, because this is the way the world is. One of the most powerful things about lament is that it tells you the way the world is. It doesn't say this is the way the world might be. This is the way we want the world to be. It says this is the way the world is. And that's what happens in Lamentations chapter 1 and 2. The format of chapter 1 and 2, and chapter 4, by the way, but the three chapters and 3/4 of the book of Lamentations is written in the style of a lament called the funeral dirge. Now, if you study lament genre in the Old Testament, you'll find there are like 10, 15 different subgenres of the larger genre of lament. Lamentations, 3 out of 5, are written in the form of the funeral dirge. And you see some of the characteristics here. The passage both begins in chapter 1 and chapter 2 with the Hebrew word akah, which means how. And the better translation is not the simple word how, but how can this be? Usually when you see that word, it means it's a lament. That word is kind of a signal. We are now going to talk about a lament. But there are other aspects of the chapter 1 and chapter 2 that point towards this is a funeral dirge. There is the use of a kinometer, which is a meter that is uneven. So typical Hebrew poetry is even metering. So 6 beats in one line, 6 beats in the second line, 7 beats in the next line, 7 beats in the next line. So the whole point of Hebrew poetry is a balanced metering. It doesn't have much rhyming or anything like that, but it usually has the same number of beats in the first line and the same number of beats in the second line. Typical Hebrew poetry. Every once in a while, Hebrew poetry would do something different, and this is one of those instances. So instead of 6 beats, 6 beats, 5 beats, 5 beats, it goes 6 beats, 3 beats, 5 beats, 2 beats, 7 beats, 6 beats. Why? Because if it's not even walking, it is uneven walking or limping. You saw what I was doing, 6 beats, 5 beats, 5 beats, 4 beats, and that's what it's called, the limping meter. And you use the limping meter when you're in pain, when things aren't right. If you're walking normally and the rhythm is normal, then life is normal. But the second you introduce a different cadence to your poetry, now you're saying something's not right here, something's off. And usually when you see the limping meter combined with the akah opening and these 9 other characteristics, according to Kathleen O'Connor, you are going to encounter a funeral dirge. And Lamentations 1, Lamentations 2, and Lamentations 4 follows just the basic characteristic of a funeral dirge. So in terms of genre, it's pretty clear what this is. Now, I point this out because a funeral is different from another form of lament. So think about this difference with me. As a pastor, I would do a lot of hospital visits. And hospital visits, there's still hope in a hospital visit. A person might be really, really sick. And there's been tragedy where a person was very sick and maybe not be able to leave the hospital. But in a hospital visit, even if the person is sick, you still have some ray of hope. So you gather around, you join hands, you read scripture, and the person grabs your hand, and you sing, and you anoint with oil. And what can happen in a hospital room, there's a hopefulness because the person is still alive. And you gather around, and you pray for that person, and the hope that person will leave the hospital soon. That's a hospital visit. But you don't do at a funeral what you did at a hospital visit. That would be completely inappropriate. Pastors, you just don't do that. You don't go to a funeral and say, all we need to do is get him out of the casket, hold hands, we'll sing kumbaya, we'll, you know, anoint him with oil, and he'll be fine the next day. You don't do that in a funeral because there is a substantive qualitative difference between what you do at a funeral and what you do at a hospital visit. Here's my concern with justice issues in the United States. Most of us think we're at a hospital visit when we're dealing with race, social injustice, economic injustice, etc. We think we just join hands and say, I love you, man, and hug it out. Things will be better once we do that hospital visit. In fact, we'll just sing a song, we'll be over, and we'll see the next day if that person gets out. We don't have to monitor it. We don't have to worry about it. That person will get better. We think one quick visit, one quick service, one quick event, and justice is taken care of. Racial injustice is done away with. Economic injustice is over and done. And we look for that quick, easy hospital visit to cure our problems. But Lamentations is written not as a hospital visit, but as a funeral. And in a funeral, you deal with the dead bodies in the room. You deal with the reality of the dead body. And in fact, if you treat that dead body like a person that's going to come to life any second, you are doing a disservice to that dead body. And much of our inability to deal with pain in our world is falsely believing that we're at a hospital when we're actually at a funeral. That there is a dead body there, and we've got to deal with the history around that dead body. We've got to note the appropriate reaction to that dead body. We must mourn and grieve that dead body. And that kind of lament is very difficult for those of us in an extremely triumphalistic culture. When the world says, no, things will get better. No, when the world says, no, just work it out. And if you just put your mind and energy to it, or elect the black president for 8 years, all those problems will go away. Just do one or two things. Follow the magic formula. It's a hospital visit after all. How bad can it be? The person will get out soon when it's actually a funeral. Because the history of the dead body is very real. I've been doing some work. My next book is working with a Native American scholar, activist. Mark Charles and I have been working on this book for a couple of years now. We hope to be, it will be out this time next year. So hopefully we'll get the manuscript done within the next month or so. And it's been an amazing blessing working with a Native American on this topic. And one of the things that we've been working through is the long history of oppression of Native Americans in our nation. And that if we don't tell the truth about it, in fact, we're hoping the book will be called Truth Be Told, because if we don't tell the truth about the Native communities, we're just pretending to put Band-Aids over deep, gushing wounds. And if we don't deal with the profound historical pain and take it all the way back to that very profound history, then we're just saying, well, it's just a quick Band-Aid and we'll be done when the person is almost bleeding out. When the community is almost bleeding out. One of the things that we've been looking at is something called the doctrine of discovery. And we've been doing a lot of research and writing on this, and I've been kind of going through the history books to try to understand the doctrine of discovery. The doctrine of discovery was a series of papal bulls that were issued in the 15th century. And two separate occasions occasioned the writing of these papal bulls as a response to two significant events. And what it did was it gave a theological justification and rationale for these two events. The two events that occurred in the 15th century was, one, the start of the transcontinental slave trade, transatlantic slave trade, and secondly, the discovery of America. The first event was when Prince Henry of Portugal, the uncle of King Alfonso, goes to the west coast of Africa and decides we're going to take human life into our possession and make them into slaves. But you can't do that because these are good Christians. How can good Christians take people into their possession, which is clearly anti-biblical? And so they needed a theological justification. And the church gave them that theological justification. The church writes, as one of the doctrine of discovery, when you go to these foreign lands, you are the true image bearer of God. As a European Christians, you are the ones that have the full image of God in you. And when you encounter a Muslim or an African, they are pagans and infidels and other, and therefore they are less human than you are. So you have every right, as the European image bearer of God, to see that other person, to gaze upon them and see them as less human, and therefore take them into your possession as chattel slave labor. So the church gave the theological justification for Prince Henry to start the slave trade. The second event, of course, is Columbus sailing the ocean blue in 1492 and coming across the ocean and discovering America. My friend Mark Charles has a great line. He says, you can't discover something that's already there when there are 6 million people and 2,000 civilizations that already own and possess the land. You can't discover something that's owned by something else, someone else. If you don't believe that, please leave your iPhones and iPads behind, and I will happily discover them for you. Because that's what happened. Columbus came to a continent filled with millions of lives and thousands of civilizations and said, hey, look what I discovered. And what gave him the justification to do that was the theological justification from the church that said, you, Columbus, and in fact, he's named it specifically in these documents written to Ferdinand and Isabella, you, Columbus, are the true image bearer of God who are doing this for the sake of the gospel, for the sake of the kingdom. So when you encounter these infidels and these pagans, they are less than you, and therefore you can discover their lands because you're the first Christian eyes to view this land. And it gave the justification for the discovery of America and to claim Columbus discovered America. These are historical realities that have had profound effect on how we have lived our lives in the 21st century. what Mark and I have worked through and looking through a lot of legal documents, is that as recently as 1972, that doctrine of discovery, that religious doctrine, was cited as legal precedent for the way the Native Americans can be treated in the United States. So this is not a 15th century document that has no effect. It was brought into the Constitution, brought into the Declaration of Independence, brought into the McIntosh decision by the Supreme Court, and as recently as 1972, re-brought back in as part of American law in how we treat Native Americans. That's a dead body in the room. And if we walk away from the dead body and said, all we need to do is let them have their casinos, we have no idea how life works and how the world works. We are called to be those who understand the reality of the situation. And that's why we need lament. We can't celebrate, hey, things are better than they were 100 years ago. At least we don't have slavery anymore, because the dead body is still in the room. We can't say, hey, what a great thing, by even though we wiped out millions of them, now they have churches in the Native communities. No, there are dead bodies in the room. We have to deal with the dead bodies in the room. And that's where honesty and truth comes in. Now, I'm talking, as I typically do in my writing, I'm talking big picture. I'm talking national history and global history and international history. And that's just the work that I do as a professor. I talk in kind of global themes. But you also have to think about what this means on the local level. What does it mean for a community to deal with honesty and truth? You can say, well, it's just a Band-Aid. Let's just put a Band-Aid on our relationship and we'll move on. Well, it's just Monty Python. It's just a flesh wound. So let's just put a little Band-Aid on it and it'll be better. We'll be fine. Or do we say, there is a dead body in this room and we can walk around it, pretend it's not there, but it's not honest. It's not truthful. It's not dealing with the reality of the situation. Again, I'm an outsider coming in from a whole different city and part of the country altogether. What I do know is that most churches operate with a hospital mentality, and we're not very good at the funeral. We don't know how to lament over the dead body. We don't know how to lament of what has been lost, because we think successful churches will always get that back. But it might be lost. It might just be lost. So how do we as God's people deal with the dead body in the room? How is honesty and truth-telling a part of it? I'll close with this final illustration about chapter 3. I love the book of Lamentations because of a lot of its subtlety. Some of you know this, but the book of Lamentations is written in the acrostic style. It's a very basic formula. You'll notice that there are 22 kind of segments within the book of Lamentations. And the reason is that chapter 1 and chapter 2, the first verse begins with the letter A and then has three verses underneath. And then the second verse begins with the letter B in the Hebrew and three verses underneath. And then the third verse, it's Aleph, Beit, Gimel. And the third verse is the letter C. So it actually goes through the letters of the alphabet, the Hebrew alphabet, in order, and then it presents three lines of it with that order. So there's a lot of reasons for this. I'm going to get to the one in just a minute. But where you see this most pronounced in chapter 3. In chapter 1, you have the first line with the letter A and then two subsequent lines. Verse 2, B, and then two subsequent lines. But in chapter 3, you get three lines, and each line begins with the letter A. And then the next three lines, each line begins with the letter B. So what it is basically what you call the intensification of the formula that was used in chapter 1 and chapter 2. So it kind of heightens the attention on chapter 3. And earlier today, we sang the one positive verse in the entire book of Lamentations. The steadfast love of the Lord never changes. His mercies never come to an end. They are new every morning. Great is thy faithfulness. That shows up in Lamentations chapter 3 because it's kind of the apex of the entire book. It actually moves like this, and then it kind of moves down like this because chapter 3 is the intensified height of the book of Lamentations. Now, I point this out because to me, there's kind of an object lesson in the way that Jeremiah has written out this story in the acrostic. That, by the way, also points to someone who was literate, who was able to kind of walk through this content. And so that's why, again, points to Jeremiah's authorship or editorship. So you end up with this intensification. But the point of it, why would you do that? number of different reasons. Some say, is it a magic formula? Well, we know that it's not, because that's what Jeremiah would say. Don't do magic formulas. But what it does is actually it gives boundaries to the pain. So if you have uncontrolled, unfettered pain that just goes in all different directions, it's actually not very helpful because you're just kind of letting it out. But then if you have some guidelines, and even the idea that if we get through the end of the alphabet, we're going to complete the whole process. So what Jeremiah does, what the author of Lamentations does, is it provides some boundaries, some support, some protection, so that this pain that they're experiencing cannot just kind of explode in all different directions. So there's a very intentional idea that the author of Lamentations is giving to you. We are going to go through the grieving process, and we're going to give you the boundaries in which that grief can be expressed. And I find that one of the things that the church should really embrace as our role in society is to be the living acrostic in a broken world. What does it mean for the church to be the living acrostic, the living boundaries, so that when someone is hurting, you say, this is what it means to be part of a community that loves you, protects you, serves you, honors you, but within these boundaries so that you could actually flourish. Because if there is unfettered, uncontrolled explosion of that emotion, that could actually leave a lot of shrapnel for other people as well. But if there is a sense of the church is the place where you are safe because of some of these boundaries, because of some of these guidelines, then maybe that actually is a place where the person can flourish rather than just explode emotionally and spiritually, but it gives that place of that safety. I'll give you an example of this. I worked in urban ministry for many years. I worked with urban youth, and one of the things that that I was involved with was a ministry called the Boston Templeton Coalition. It was mostly African-American clergy. I was the only Asian, actually the only non-black person who was part of this coalition. It was one of the best years of my life, because one of the things that we would do is we would work with the police. In fact, Harvard did an extensive study. Christopher Winship, sociologist at Harvard, did an extensive study on the impact of the Boston 10-point coalition on gang violence in the city of Boston. I believe it was a 2.5-year stretch where not a single juvenile was a victim of gun violence, which for a city of our size is phenomenal. I mean, I live in Chicago now, and every other day there's some kind of gun violence with children, involved with children under the age of 18. In Boston, for 2.5 years, not a single event of a homicide of a juvenile. And everybody was talking about it. Janet Reno, the attorney general at that time, comes up to Boston and says it's the Boston miracle. And one of the things that Christopher Winship, Harvard sociologist, found was the role of the Boston 10-Point Coalition. And here's some of the stuff that the 10-Point Coalition did. Made its presence known in the community. Would go out there on the most, the nights and the places where we knew gang violence would occur, wear the clerical collars, and walk out into those parks and say, we're a presence here. All right, go ahead. Let's see what happens. We're not going to allow gang violence in this park this weekend. To be the visible presence of the living God in the midst of the most broken places. The other things we do, we would go to people's homes. A kid would appear on the police blotter for having brought gang colors to school or a weapon or a knife to school. And so we would get their name, and two police officers and two clergy would go and visit their homes. So I've been in the back of a police car, just to let you know. But not in that way. I was riding along with two police officers. We would go to their house, and the law would come in and strongly say, this is what it means for the police to have you on our list. And the church would come in and say, this is what it means for you to be loved by God's people. We come to our church on Sunday. We will send somebody here to pick you up. We became the living embodiment of Christ, the acrostic in the midst of a broken world. And I pray that more churches would learn what it means to be that acrostic in the midst of a broken world. What it means to be a place of, not comfort, but safety. I want to distinguish between the two. Not happiness, but joy. You know the difference, right? Happiness comes and goes. Happiness comes on Christmas when you get the toy that you want. Happiness comes when, you know, the Giants are doing well, or the A's. Happiness comes when, you know, all these good things happen to you. And happiness changes from moment to moment, from event to event. Joy is there from sunrise to sunset. Joy is there when your life is broken and your world is broken. Joy does not waver in the midst of suffering. Joy perseveres and is present in the midst of suffering. So can the church be that place, a place of joy, not just happiness, a place of safety, not just comfort? Can we be the living acrostic that the world so desperately needs? Let me pray for us, and then I think we're going to have to dismiss. We'll close up, but I want to leave the 30 minutes before lunch for Q&A, and we'll want to invite people to stay. Let me close and pray for us. Lord, thank you for allowing us to be a part of your kingdom. What a gift, what a treasure. In a broken world, to not have to run away and hide, but to be the living embodiment of who you are. And I do pray for brokenness in our midst, that in any community there will be brokenness. In any gathering of your people, there will be brokenness, there will be pain. There will be places where we look upon with shame. There will be dead bodies, there will be broken bodies and broken lives in the midst of us. And those things can be ignored and put under the rug and just kind of walked around. Or we can say, God, show us what it means to be faithful in the joyful times and the fun times, but also in the times of pain. Show us what it means to be your people, united on one purpose and one heart, not only when times are good, but when times are difficult. Show us what it means to be the followers of Jesus who take up the cross through all sorts of circumstances to be the people, not only in Jerusalem, but also in Babylon. We pray this in your name. Amen.